Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Raising taxes in the middle of this economic situation we're in is a terrible idea. I mean, just look at the unemployment figures last Friday.
The summer of 2011 is becoming the summer of brinksmanship on the debt ceiling, Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell on Fox News Sunday there. And reportedly, President Obama and House Speaker John Boehner almost had a historic 10-year grand bargain to cut $3 trillion in spending and raise $1 trillion in revenues by closing some tax loopholes, all intended to chip away at the national debt. Now, by all accounts, Boehner and Obama are developing a good working relationship, but also by all accounts, Boehner backed away from the deal Saturday night after deciding that other congressional Republicans would still reject it as a tax hike. Again, Mitch McConnell.
We have 9.2% unemployment. Their prescription is to raise taxes? I mean, my goodness, who thinks that's... The president didn't think that was a good idea in December. Why do they think it's a good idea now?
And remember the context here. Congress must vote to raise the debt ceiling by August 2nd, or the U.S. government will probably begin to default on its debts. Republicans are pushing the president to agree to long-term debt reduction before raising the ceiling for now. The president has scheduled a news conference for 11 o'clock. We will carry it live. Right now, we'll get a preview of sorts from Democratic Congressman Jim Himes of Connecticut, a member of the Financial Services Committee, who is here in our studio. Hey, Congressman, welcome back to WNYC.
Good morning, Brian. Great to be here.
How close are you to these negotiations? Can you confirm the sequence of events I was just describing?
Well, I'm not that close to them. The meetings that happened over the weekend were leadership meetings. And while I talk from time to time with the leadership, you know, again, I wasn't in the room. And these are negotiations that, you know, if they're going to be successful, a lot of those rooms are going to be pretty empty because they're going to look, a successful negotiation here means both sides taking some hits with their base. And that's hard to publicize when you're talking about it.
I want you to help our listeners as we talk first about the Republican base, and then we'll talk about the Democratic base and why some Democrats may not be happy with the president for even proposing this deal. But I want you to help our listeners to understand this term loopholes that all the media is using. If the problem is that Republicans see closing loopholes as an actual tax increase, what does that actually mean? Loopholes sound like things that people are getting away with that were not intended. But I have a feeling that's not what they all are in this case, are they?
Well, loopholes are exceptions in the tax code that are made for industries, that are made for individuals. And I mean, to sort of play out the politics for you, sure. You know, it's very easy to say, as frankly I have said, because I think they're absurd, that we shouldn't be giving tax breaks, that is, you know, faster depreciation or whatever it may be, to oil companies. ExxonMobil reported $11 billion in profits in one quarter. I think it's fair to say that perhaps they don't need subsidies. Now, of course, you know, an awful lot of Americans out there get a deduction for the mortgage interest that they pay. Not just the mortgage interest, but a lot of Americans are getting deductible interest on home equity loans. This is, I went out and bought a boat, and that interest on that is deductible because it's – so, you know, there you have two sides of it. You know, an economist would say both are bad ideas, but obviously both have their strong advocates.
I have a list from liberal economist Jared Bernstein of loopholes, and they're also sometimes called tax expenditures, and how much money they could bring into the government to close the debt. Many of these are income tax deductions, as you say. So, for example, itemized deductions at no more than 28% for incomes over $250,000. You can now deduct up to whatever your tax bracket is, 33% of those expenditures. Or just eliminate itemized deductions for incomes over $1 million. He says that would bring in $475 billion to the Treasury over the next decade, almost half a trillion. Itemized deductions at no more than 15% for all Americans. That would be $1.2 trillion right there. So if you changed the tax deduction rules, you know, deductions for things like mortgage interest and charity and whatever else people typically do, but just capped how much you could do it, it would be huge, huge income generators for the federal government. Is that a lot of what this discussion is about?
Well, you know, the facts are actually not that hard to deal with, right? And if, you know, the magnitude of these tax expenditures, these loopholes, these deductions, they're all basically the same thing, is massive. I mean, it's almost it's in excess of $1 trillion a year in foregone tax receipts for the agriculture industry, for the oil industry, for middle-class Americans that itemized deductions. Where it gets really complicated, of course, is that if somebody is used to getting a tax break, I don't care if that's the middle-class homeowner or the oil industry or the high-tech industry, which gets a research and development credit, guess what? You're not going to go quietly into that good night when the proposal is to do away with them. The question is, of course, I mean, you gave some examples there. The question is, who should bear more or less burden under the tax code right now? And there are people who articulate an argument that I think has real merit, which is that over the last 20 years, the very top income brackets in this country have done spectacularly well, in contrast to, frankly, the rest of the income brackets in the country. So perhaps it's fair to say, hey, is it crazy to go back to the tax rates of the Clinton era? You know, the economy was doing pretty well back then. Nobody was sort of feeling like that was class warfare. And so the Republican resistance to this notion of going back to tax rates of the Clinton era, and by the way, they won't even go that far. They won't allow for us to remove loopholes.
And this is just about loopholes for now, right? This is not about raising the top, top income tax bracket. The marginal rates. This is not repealing or letting expire the Bush tax cuts, right?
And here's where the politics is interesting. You know, I think the speaker walked out of the talks on Saturday night because he recognized that his caucus and, in fact, the sort of more right wing of his conference wouldn't sustain any increase in revenue. He wasn't talking, and no Republican is talking about an increase in rates, but he was saying, let's talk about those loopholes. Well, I think he got chastened over the weekend by people like Eric Cantor, the number two in the House, who say no, any changes to the tax code must be revenue neutral.
Congressman Jim Himes, Democrat from Connecticut, my guest on WNYC as we talk about the debt ceiling negotiations. One of the Republican positions is that closing some of these tax loopholes, in fact, especially the one that the Democrats most likely seem to harp on. I saw you beating up on the oil companies when you were on CNBC this morning and how they shouldn't get these special loopholes. But also on that same show, you had the governor of Wyoming saying, look, the energy companies in that state would suffer if some of these loopholes, so-called, were closed, and that would mean fewer jobs in the middle of this jobs recession. Do they have a point?
Well, anytime you take away a tax benefit from somebody or something, you can say that that individual or that entity is going to suffer. So the question is, you know, how do we feel about tax subsidies that are going to oil companies being taken away and them, quote unquote, suffering? Look, the oil companies execs themselves several years ago said that it wouldn't alter the rate of their production. Of course, they don't want those benefits to go away any more than you and I want the deductions that we get to go away. And yes, you know, you pointed out, I mentioned the oil companies, but look, what we need here is something fair. And I think I'm one of the few members of Congress who signed up and said I would vote for Simpson-Bowles, which, as you know, was a comprehensive, not just taxes, but cuts, Medicare, social, the whole ball of wax. That's the kind of thinking we need. And unfortunately, the president, of course, is saying we'll talk about Medicare and Social Security, making a lot of left-wing, in particular Democrats, very, very nervous. But the Republicans have drawn a hard line and said we will not look to the tax code for revenues. This at a point in time when our tax receipts as a percentage of GDP are lower than they have been since 1958, when we lived in a very, very different world.
Other loopholes that the president's proposal wants to close, I've read, include ones for hedge fund managers and the purchase of corporate aircraft by executives. We all know about the corporate jet deduction by now because the president keeps talking about it. You represent a pretty affluent area of Connecticut with lots of finance sector workers who are on the finance committee. Is this an easy call for you when we talk about tax breaks for hedge fund managers?
Well, you know, the reason we talk about tax breaks for hedge fund managers and corporate jets and oil companies is because those are pretty easy to get the bulk of the American people saying, hey, yeah, that sounds like a good idea. But look, if we really push here, those are relatively small amounts of money compared, for example, to something which you don't hear people demagoguing, which is the mortgage interest tax deduction. Now, there's something that an awful lot of Americans care. But by the way, that's a form of subsidy that on balance helps the middle class and above.
So what's actually on the table here? I've read one version is to take it away for second homes or cap it in the ways that we were talking about before. So if you make over $1 million a year or over $250,000 a year or whatever the cutoff would be, then you get less of a home mortgage interest tax deduction.
Right, right. And this sort of gets to fairness. You know, if you're going to try to make sure that everybody helps here, you're probably going to look to some of those things. And look, as a matter of politics and as a matter of policy, I'm not sure right now is the proper moment to really be messing around with the housing industry. I think the realtors and others make a pretty good case in that regard. But, you know, can I justify mortgage interest tax deductions for that second home? That's a little hard to explain when we've got a very serious deficit issue.
All right, let's look at the Democrat side of the equation. The president is reportedly offering cuts to Medicare, Medicaid, and Social Security. And let's not overlook how controversial those things could be with the Democratic base and with Americans who depend today or who will in the future on those programs. Again, here's Republican Senate leader Mitch McConnell.
I commend the president for putting Medicare and Social Security on the table. He is correct in doing that. You can't have a serious deficit reduction program without dealing with those programs in the long term.
So I think this is the overlooked 800-pound gorilla in the room, the Republican leadership praising the president for offering cuts to Social Security and Medicare. What kind of cuts are the president and your party actually offering here?
Well, look, we need to talk about this in a slightly different way. And McConnell is dead wrong about something, which is that you absolutely can have a deficit reduction conversation about the deficit this year and next year without talking about Social Security and Medicare. Social Security and Medicare have not contributed to the deficit over time. In fact, Social Security has actually given money to the general fund for most of its existence until this past year. Now, that doesn't mean that in the long run, and hopefully we do it sooner rather than later, you don't need to put both programs on a more sustainable path. They combined have a huge unfunded liability, but it's not about the deficit this year. So yes, we should talk about how we do that, and we should fight. I certainly feel an obligation to fight that any changes in those programs don't ask our seniors, don't ask our poor, don't ask our disenfranchised to bear a disproportionate burden.
But then what is the president offering on, let's say, Social Security in particular?
Well, you know, I don't know the details of what he's offering because I wasn't in the room. But, you know, Social Security is actually the easy one here, right? In 1983, Reagan and O'Neill came together and struck a deal that raised the retirement age a little bit, raised the withholding on wages, and got it more sustainable. That's what we need to do again.
So we're going to see a little maybe higher retirement age agreed to by the Democrats in this deal, or less cost of living adjustment to seniors already on Social Security?
You'll certainly see that discussed. Now, remember, in 83, there was a slight increase in the retirement age, and the Simpson-Bowles proposal very, very gently raised the retirement age over time. You know, there are Democrats who don't like that. But the reality is, again, these negotiations only work when you walk out of the room not entirely liking everything.
How about means testing Social Security? Do you think that's on the table?
You know, I think means testing Social Security and Medicare is a key part of this.
Absolutely.
Look, I have very affluent people in my district who come up to me and say, look, it's just absurd that I'm getting the same Social Security check or that I'm paying the same premiums for my health insurance as somebody who's poor. Now, and by the way, you know, Congressman Ryan, when he made his proposal for Medicare, included some means testing in there. So I don't think that that's a terribly controversial topic the way some are.
Talking about the debt ceiling negotiations with Democratic Congressman Jim Himes of Connecticut. Want to take some calls?
Sure.
212-433-WNYC. Aaron in Norwalk. You're on WNYC. Hi there.
Hi, Representative Himes. This is Aaron Hall.
Hey, Aaron. How are you?
Great. Hey, with this partisan budget battle that's going on, it seems like President Obama's trying to do an end run around the Republicans and say, okay, you want reduction, let's go to the $4 billion mark and call the bluff. If we play this partisan challenge of neither side blinking, nothing, they talked in the New York Times today about a 10-year opening, nothing's going to get done. In terms of your relationships as a moderate Democrat, what do you see as some of the interpersonal challenges of getting this done with some of the Tea Party Republicans and even some of the far-left Democrats when the rubber meets the road in the halls of Congress? What do you see as a potential solution for a workaround for these really difficult partisan walls to
Great question, Aaron. Look, you know, a deal here is going to happen in the middle. It's going to happen if Nate Silver is correct in his calculus with, you know, 100 or so Republicans, which, of course, is a minority of their conference.
It's still a lot of Republicans for a conference in the House that almost always votes unanimously on things like this.
Yeah, but look, and this is Boehner's challenge. And, you know, it's no coincidence that over these many talks, it has always been the Republicans that have walked out of the room. Coburn, Boehner, Cantor, walking out of negotiations that are all about the credit and the financial stability of this country. Why do they do that? Because at some point, the right wing, the Tea Party, says, no, you cannot compromise. Now, look, the left wing of the Democratic Party is not at all happy about the fact that the president brought up Social Security and Medicare. They're certainly not comfortable with the concept of cuts. But look, that's a broader discussion. You can reform those programs in a fair and equitable way. But it is the other side that is constantly walking out of these negotiations. And look, I feel for the management challenge that John Boehner has right now. You know, he may not be speaker if he goes too far to meet halfway with this president.
Jamie in Franklin Lakes, you're on WNYC. Hi, Jamie.
Good morning, Brian. You're talking about all these revenues bringing in. Are you saying this is all going to be put to the deficit and that there's no increases in spending by the government?
Well, I don't think anybody is proposing any increases in spending by the government, any time in the next couple of years.
But let's be clear. What a lot of this is the projected increases in spending in Medicare and Social Security because of the aging of the baby boomers, correct?
Well, you're exactly right, and I should have been clearer about that. I was talking about discretionary spending, that little piece of the budget that we actually get to vote on. There is no question that because of the aging of our population that Medicare expenditures and Social Security expenditures are going way up. And that, of course, is the sustainability problem that we have with those programs. This is why this discussion is to some degree dishonest. You know, if you look at a pie of where the federal government spends its money, it's about 15% that is not either mandatory, Medicare, Social Security, Medicaid, or take out the $800 billion we spend on defense and security. You've got this little sort of 15% slice that the Republicans are saying cut that severely. You know, they're not willing to talk about cutting defense, and they're not willing to talk about revenue. So what happens in their vision is that, you know, Pell Grants and student loans and investment in highways, it just goes away.
Joe in Mahwah, you're on WNYC. Hey, Joe.
Yeah, hi, Brian. My problem is 100 million blacks, Hispanics, and Asians' life expectancy, especially for male, is progressively worse than as you. It's around 65. For blacks, it's around 62. So the retirement age right now is 67. So it's consistently unfair to the minorities that you keep on increasing the retirement age. But isn't there a better alternative, for example, progressive tax system for those who are making $4 billion on Wall Street? Tax them at the rate of 70% and don't give them any benefits.
Joe, you make a great point about disparate life expectancies in the United States, and it's by race, as he says. I suspect that it's also by job categories. So people may be living to about 80 now on average in America, but if you can't retire with Social Security from your construction job until you're close to 70, and that's the same age as someone who works in an office, or if demographically your life expectancy, because of all kinds of, you know, underlying social conditions, is going to be much shorter than others, can we really impose the same blanket Social Security age on the whole country?
Yeah, no, that's a great question. Look, I say this all the time, which is that some guys wear ties to work and other guys lift heavy objects, right? And you have to make a distinction between that. But it's also important to remember, I get so uncomfortable with this talk about the retirement age and the age at which you retire. Let's remember that what we're really talking about is the age at which you can start getting retirement benefits from the Social Security system. The date at which you can retire, and this is true for not all Americans, but a lot of Americans, has everything to do with how much you save. Do you choose to spend all your salary over your working life, or do you save for retirement? And the reason I say that is that one of the real messes this country is in is inadequate savings. We don't want a country where every American is relying on Social Security for the entirety of their retirement. But nonetheless, the point is good. You know, you got to make allowances for people who are working very, very physically demanding jobs.
Joe, call us again. We're almost out of time. I just want to throw in that to many people, Jim Himes is known as one of the most honest tweeters in Washington, cracking jokes and ribbing fellow representatives. Let me ask about your tweeting philosophy, given how problematic that practice has been for a certain local congressman
right
who we were discussing earlier in the hour.
Yeah, look, I you know, at a moment in time when people feel pretty alienated from their government, I use Twitter not for policy discussions, but just to sort of say what's going on and what's, you know, the human interest, as the media says, side of things. But yeah, I try to stay away from the photographs and the kind of things that we saw here in New York City.
Yeah, we think that Anthony Weiner is probably downgrading his data plan even as we speak. But last week, fellow Congressman Chris Murphy tweeted about sitting on the tarmac during a delay at JFK Airport, and you tweeted back, take the train, man.
Yeah, easy for me to say, right? I've got Southern Connecticut. He's way up there in Cheshire. I'm not sure he can take the train, which, by the way, opens the discussion for mass transit and high-speed rail.
And your job, by the way, when you walk out the door, is to retweet the photo of you sitting here with me that we just took.
Excellent. Will do.
Tweeted. Jim Himes, Democratic congressman from Connecticut. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Brian.
And we will carry President Obama's debt ceiling news conference, which is scheduled to start at about 11 o'clock. Brian Lehrer, WNYC. But coming up first, we will look behind that one tip to a tiny belly web ad that seems to pop up no matter what you click on. And we will give you some reasons for not clicking through. Stay tuned.